Leslie Ann, how do you feel about cheese? What's your favorite type of cheese?
My favorite's Gouda.
Welcome to Rebalancing Act. We are Kieran and Leslie Ann, two law grads and friends. We know that climate change is happening and that we need to solve it. That's why every second Friday, we come together and talk about what we need to do and how we get there. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you for coming along with us for our first season. The one where we tried a bunch of things to see what worked. We really proverbially threw a bunch of pasta at the wall, and I think that some of it actually stuck. And now with our new season, we're going to continue trying some new things. Let us know how you like them. Stick with us for the next 6 months and learn about climate solutions through the four natural elements. Those are earth, fire, air, and water. Climate change is a systemic problem, and we wanted to go through solutions in a systematic way. And we thought, what better way to do it than with a series that focused on the elements in our beautiful world? Plus, Avatar The Last Airbender was trending on Netflix. And what better nod from the universe is there? Seriously, it's worth pausing the podcast for. But today, if you are still listening, we're going to start with Earth. And specifically, we're going to talk about our relationship with the living things that surround us. Earth, dirt, whatever you want to call it. It's all the same, right? Or maybe not. Does it matter what we label the stuff on the ground? That you know that your food grows in, but you're definitely not prepared to have tracked inside your house. So, I mean, what is dirt in the elemental sense? Well, I can tell you in the non-elemental sense that my own sense of dirt has changed over time. I guess I always thought that dirt was kind of dirty. Now, this lined up with my sense of how lots of things are portrayed. Skin? It gets dirty, you gotta clean that. Not just the hands, because those are important, generally speaking, and when we're living through a pandemic. But everything. It's an identity thing. Do you wash your legs in the shower? The people that do couldn't imagine doing it any other way and are probably a little bit freaked out at the possibility that other people aren't. Even more so if you have bad skin. Acne? Definitely gotta sterilize that out of existence, every teenager has felt, even though we know that that's not necessarily the best way to treat it. Counters, kitchens, it's all meant to be sterilized. Can't track anything in from outside after all, and I mean, it even goes inside. Do you want to purify your body and purge toxins? Seems simple. But I've been learning about how all these beliefs that we hold and that we act on, they're not always true. They're also not necessarily neutral. It turns out, we rely on the fact that the world is full of living things, teeming with microbes, in fact, for lots of things, for our bodies. Even though it sounds freaky, you probably want a gut full of different bacteria. We know that fiber is good for us for lots of reasons. But one of them turns out that if you eat more fiber, you have more diverse gut flora. Okay, if you're not into that reason, I can understand that. I have a few others as well. Let's talk about cheese. If you've ever enjoyed anything from a new cheddar to an old oozy camembert or blue cheese, you might know that the magic that turns milk into the wonder of cheese is, you might have guessed it, it's bacteria. Good bacteria can even act as a preservative and prevent the growth of bad bacteria, like in the process of fermentation. I find it really hard to imagine life before the advent of refrigeration. But back in the day, you couldn't count on keeping things cold. If you want an awesome cheesy story, I have to tell you about Mother Noella of Bethlehem, Connecticut. Mother Noella is a Benedictine nun at the Abbey Regina Laudis. The Abbey started producing raw milk cheeses using traditional techniques like a wooden barrel, an endeavor that was flavorfully enhanced by Mother Noella's microbiology PhD. When an outbreak of food poisoning caused the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, to ban raw milk cheeses, Mother Noella campaigned for an exception because those bacteria strains are important and her cheeses are really tasty. And also because, under the new regulations, And without the good bacteria imbuing her wooden cheese-making barrel, being given a metal substitute bowl instead, all of the cheese kept on getting E. coli. She did get an exception. Now, this story is notable for a few reasons. Well, we have women in positions of leadership, a message that we here at Rebalancing Act definitely endorse. We, of course, have a story about the centrality of bacteria to the food that we eat, and we have an excuse to talk about one of nature's tastiest foods, in my opinion at least, cheese. So if you're asking, Kieran, why are you giving us what seems like a pretty unscientific science lesson about bacteria? Well, that's a good question. Living organisms, the ones that are all around us, no matter how much Lysol we use, are also the secret sauce that make food and everything else grow. What is dirt? I think maybe the more interesting question is, what is soil and how is it alive? It's dirt, where it belongs, and so much more. Soil is a mix of rocks, minerals, organic matter, air, water, carbon, and of course microbes. The mix of a particular soil depends on how and where it's formed. Soil helps food grow. I mean, it's key, really. By providing a habitat for all sorts of helpful creepy crawlies, and providing food with water, oxygen, and nutrients. Without it, we wouldn't actually have anything else. And, I mean, this is really unfortunate, but the way that we're currently using soil to farm food right now is actually pretty bad, and it's definitely unsustainable. Predominant farming practices, which include growing monocultures, annual crops, tilling the soil in a manner releasing carbon, and leaching nutrients from the soil. The use of predominant farming practices that include growing monocultures, lack of crop rotation, tilling the soil, and annual crops actually releases carbon and nutrients from the soil, so that amendments needed to be added and sometimes the soil is degraded. Turns out if we don't change our farming practices, there are estimates that we're going to run through the rest of our topsoil, soil that takes decades to regenerate, before the century's out. But I mean, don't take away from this anecdote that we're screwed, because we're not. Take away instead that we can, have to, and will make the changes that we need to make farming sustainable. Since the best types of problems are ones with solutions, Leslie Ann is here to discuss what exactly we can do with this problem and how soil, or earth, can be turned from a climate problem to a carbon sink. That's what I call a win-win-win. And here's Leslie Ann.
So I think for regenerative farming is such an interesting thing to talk about. What, I don't know if the idea of regenerative farming evokes anything for you.
There's a lot of movements that talk about what kind of farming we should all be wanting. We talk about the 100-mile diet or the 100-kilometer diet, where you should be buying local. We talk about organic farms. We talk about non-GMO farms. But regenerative farming, to me, is something that's not so much about the consumer and us deciding what kind of farming we want to buy from, but it's about seeing farmers as having a different relationship with what they're doing, and that relationship being really focused on sustainability. Not to say that other farmers aren't necessarily, but as a movement, that tends to be what I associate with regenerative farming.
Definitely. I think that's a pretty descriptive definition, actually. I think for better or worse, probably, definitely for better, actually. Regenerative farming isn't really one specific practice. People have interpreted it in lots of different ways. But I think, you know, I was discussing earlier about how a lot of common agricultural practices are inherently destructive to the environment that they're working in, specifically topsoil, because a lot of modern farming just uses topsoil faster than it can be regenerated. It's like, that's the simple math problem in our soils, just the way that on some very, very basic level, climate change is a math problem that belies way more complex factors. I'd say the really simple math problem belying really complex factors in this case is how fast soil can rejuvenate itself, essentially. So, I mean, there's actually lots of different ways that regenerative farming is being tried by different actors. And it's cool. There's perennial grains. I read an article recently that I'll put in the show notes about how in Australia, farmers are trying to use native perennial grains because if it works, then that means that you know, it's almost less work. You don't have to plant them every year. Maybe your bread won't be made out of wheat, but it will be made out of something perennial that's native to Australia. I also have seen plans for regenerative farming that involve mini ecosystems, kind of like if you shrunk a farm, you know, you have the field, but then you have the little trees around it. You have the animal walking through the field, pooping everywhere to provide the soil with amendments, naturally speaking. You have things that shade it. You have things that choke at all of the weeds. Just a whole bunch of little symbiotic relationships happening. And then I've also seen things that are, you know, less elaborate because obviously creating something like that would be a huge change. So I've seen, like I mentioned with the animal pooping, there's more targeted use of animal agriculture where manure and animal byproducts are used to fertilize the ground. I've also seen no-till systems, which means that you don't upturn the earth in between crop rotations, in between seasons, because that helps keep carbon in the soil. And I've also seen stuff like crop rotation, where you rotate out crops that use nitrogen from the soil to crops like legumes. So for example, like chickpeas, also clover, and other nitrogen fixation. So I think it's cool because a lot of these systems permit the, like you mentioned, the farming in a more sustainable way, and then also have this added benefit, a lot of them keeping carbon in the soil. So increasing the carbon content of soil, which we know that measurably in soil goes down after we start to farm it using conventional methods.
Are there ways that we can increase the carbon levels in soil as a carbon sink beyond maybe just their standard carbon level, or would you get into like carbon acidification?
It's kind of a cool debate that's happening. So there are definitely actors and, you know, studies that say that naturally speaking, soil is at say 10 to 12% carbon, but who knows how much carbon we could store in agricultural soil. And then I've also heard the, you know, who knows, technology is magical. And then I've also heard the other side of the debate that says that, you know, what happens when you have more carbon in the soil is you get a bog. And we're very pro preserving peatlands, bogs as a natural ecosystem, but you can't necessarily grow food in them. So I think the jury is still out and actively deliberating on that. But I think it's also regarded as a question. So that's like, you know, when people do these kind of fanciful, what if we use this one climate solution to reverse climate change completely, which is, to be frank, not realistic, but it's, you know, more of a thought exercise. And I think people haven't really decided exactly how much carbon could be stored in the soil, particularly because, unlike with some other methods that are more permanent, like injecting it into rock formations, I think there's just more of a natural exchange between the air and the soil. The nice thing is that while these debates are going on, I think everyone's pretty much agreed that more can be stored in the soil than currently is.
So I know we like food and growing food, but now I'm just trying to figure out if I can grow my own bog. I might do some Googling later. I love a good bog.
Do you know where you'd put the bog?
Not yet. Can I, like, make a mini bog for my balcony? Can that be my climate solution of the week? A balcony bog!
A balcony bog. You know what? If you branded it properly, it would sell really well on Instagram.
Oh, it definitely would.
Nature's own climate solution. I like sitting on your balcony, though. I don't know if I'm down to relinquish my balcony spot to the bog.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, a big plant pot that's, you know, maybe 24 inches radius. It would just be one corner of the balcony would be a bog, and then we could all sit around the bog.
Like a fire, but wetter.
Yeah. Yeah. And carbonier.
It's true. Instead of expelling carbon into the air, it'd be right back in there.
Exactly.
There's your homework.
Is this going to be my project 2021? Last year we made a podcast. This year I'm going to make a bog.
I feel like we can report back next episode. find out whether Leslie Ann's balcony bog is feasible or fanciful.
Ooh, I like that. I will let you all know. Follow along on the Instagram as I research.
So in addition to Leslie Ann's likely barrier to bog success on any level probably being her landlord, there are some other barriers that farmers looking to practice more regeneratively, or few of them are actually very fixable. So a lot of agricultural subsidies will subsidize machines, but frequently people trying to practice more regenerative agriculture find that they need less machines and more labor. So I know that one option is to change the way across different jurisdictions that subsidies for agriculture are given. I also think probably the biggest one, and as a non-farmer, I don't think I can really complain about this, is that like in the way that we do anything, there's a lot of inertia in farming. It just makes sense that if you farmed a certain way, maybe the way that your parents also farmed, you're maybe not inclined for someone to come and tell you how to do it differently. Especially because I know that it's a sentiment among farmers that people that eat their food don't necessarily understand or appreciate the life of a farmer.
Absolutely, and especially when for so many farmers, margins can be tight when your livelihood depends on the weather, how late the spring is, how early you're getting frost. There's a lot of uncontrollable variables that can be hard to want to plan to invest more money in something that you don't necessarily consider an essential.
I think that that's very fair, and I think that there are larger conversations to be had about this issue. I know no farmers. You know, growing up in the city, I just wasn't around any. And I think that it's unfortunate.
That's a wild concept to me. Still, like, I know you've told me this before, but the idea of just not knowing any farmers just blows my mind. And it reminds me so much of how much of a disconnect there is between rural farming communities and so much of the country. It reminds me of when I used to be a camp counselor. I had a camper who was eating, I don't actually remember what he was eating, something with pork in it. And he turned to me and asked me, what animal does pork come from? And I told him pigs. And he was quite upset with that answer. It was so bizarre to me to think of the fact that people can live so disconnected from their food that they don't know what animal it's coming from. Whereas for me, I couldn't even tell you the first time I went to a farm because it's just always been a thing I've done. I've always had friends who were family friends who were farmers, my parents' friends, my friends. And so I knew that chickens turn into chicken, cows turn into beef, cows make milk. I've always known these things. And it's that disconnect still just astounds me today. It amazes me that we can live in such a disconnected world from someone who provides such an essential service for all of us.
Definitely. I think that it's an important thing to work on. I actually have a very distinct memory in my head of being 7 and a girl in my class becoming a vegetarian after she watched Chicken Run. So I can pretty definitively say that was Chicken Run was for her the moment that chickens and chicken probably got connected together.
Yeah, but great movie.
It's quite explicit.
It was one of my brother and I's favorite movies as kids. We thought it was hilarious. But this conversation also makes me think of how I always dismissed it as a little bit silly that here in Toronto we have Riverdale Farm. I remember when I first moved here, I told a friend that I was moving to the area, and he said, oh, you'll be so close to the farm. He followed up with, I think it's even free to go in and see the animals. Well, sweetie, the day I pay to see a cow, I need help. But the more we talk about this, the more I realize that there actually is a need for a little bit of that, for folks to be able to see, even on a small scale, maybe a little bit of what a farm looks like, a little bit of what kind of work might go into it, what these animals look like, how big a cow actually is, how big a pig can actually be.
Honestly, I had such a big shock when I was with my dad's cousin and we were at a fair and she said, just you wait, the teacup pig is coming. And let me tell you, it might not have been a big pig, but I wouldn't call that pig a small pig. There is no teacup, not even the teacup ride, that could hold that pig.
Pigs are giant, and people don't realize. Wilbur in Charlotte's Web and Babe in the City were not good representations of the size of pigs.
The funny thing is, like, kids love animals. They do. When I was in the neighborhood Facebook group, when I still had Facebook, and for COVID, the farm was closed for a while, and the moms were upset because the kids were upset. So I really do think that even though it might seem inauthentic, and like maybe it is totally, I think Riverdale Farm is just an example of how we need exposure to animals in our lives and not just dogs and cats.
Definitely. Of all shapes and sizes.
Truly. Maybe even one that can fit in your miniature bog.
Ooh, I hope so. Maybe like a little frog. I've seen frogs at the farm.
If there is anything to take away, though, actually bogs and peatlands store a lot of carbon. We need those.
We do. Even if I don't make my own bog, I just want you all to know that I love bogs enough. I thought about it. Because not only are they just great and a fun word and a fun place to hang out, they're a great carbon solution.
They really are. And here's to hoping that soil can store a whole bunch of carbon without becoming bog-like. Because soil is also very necessary and important.
Absolutely.
And exciting. I think that, I mean, of all the things, the fact that soil can help mitigate and solve climate change feels pretty exciting to me.
Especially because it's something that's literally everywhere. It's on top of mountains, it's under the sea. So if we could just start tucking a little more carbon in there.
Thank you, Leslie Ann. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in today to talk about the bounty that is Earth. We've only skimmed the surface, but we have more earthy content coming for you. In 2 Fridays from now, you'll be hearing more Earth content as we interview a soil carbon expert. And in the meantime, if you're craving some more Rebalancing Act, you can follow us on Twitter at @RebalancingAct_, Instagram at @RebalancingAct, and you can sign up for our newsletter at rebalancingact.ca. See you soon!